I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. I'll never forget the stunning news from our third grade teacher that those two big eyes on a bee are compound eyes, and that each has thousands of lenses. There just wasn't any way I could relate to that. I had only two eyes. They're different colors, by the way. And only two lenses, one per eye. What's a bee, supposed to do with thousands of lenses? Why would anybody need so many? And above all else, what would it be like to experience the world this way? In this episode of Constant Wonder, we actually won't pursue the anatomical science of a bee's eyes. We won't get to bee's knees either, if you're old enough to know that expression. But we will spend time in this episode with surprising aspects of this insect's mind and intelligence and life experience. We'll do so with a couple of researchers who are in the thick of observing and trying to understand bee sentience as a whole. What they've learned is likely to give us new vision, which is to say some new empathy for the life and the mind of a bee. Please note that I said a bee, a single creature. Part of a group, to be sure, a hive. But our guest experts are finding that almost certainly a bee is more independent in its individual experience than you or I have likely ever given it credit for. There is absolutely wonder to be found in the collective functionality of a bee colony, the hive mind, as we like to say. But today we'll focus on the wonder of the individual. We'll lean on our guests to help us, at least metaphorically, see through the many eyes of such an insect.
The bee has to carry this transponder, which looks huge. It's about 50 millimeters long, this little antenna on the back, but it's very lightweight compared to the carrying capacity of a bee.
This transponder is a man-made device. Lars Chitka is a German zoologist and ecologist. He's based at Queen Mary University of London and is author of The Mind of a Bee. We'll turn our attention to him, and then we'll also get to know this scientist named Tim Landgraf.
We glue little circular binary markers on their backs. And then that bee has a name or a number. And our computer vision pipeline detects those tags and decodes the number.
Tim Landgraf is a professor of artificial and collective intelligence at the Free University of Berlin. Applying these individual tags, he's not counting beans, which would be my preference. He's numbering and tracking bees in order to observe and record their comings and goings, their behavior, their decision-making, their communication, everything we can possibly know about what happens in a bee's mind. We're going to hear from each of these researchers not only descriptions of some experiments they've been doing, but also some of their informed speculations about an individual bee's quality of life. Lars Chitka.
We are surrounded by other minds in the same way as we are thinking and feeling and suffering and enjoying beings. There are other thinking and feeling and suffering and enjoying beings all around us. So we don't need to travel to outer space to encounter strange life forms. They're right here under our noses. That does inspire in me, at least, a new kind of fascination to just think about how many different perceptual worlds there are in animals that see the world, smell the world, and so on in ways completely different from us.
Whenever we draw comparisons, we talk of similarities and differences. Is bee thought or bee memory or vision or navigation or even emotion like or unlike human experience? Emily Dickinson returned again and again to these human-animal comparisons or juxtapositions in her poetry. Snake, fox, firefly, butterfly, lark, leech, flamingo, a seemingly endless list of creatures to consider and identify with. When it came to bees, her buccaneers of buzz, as she once called them, she exclaimed, "Oh, for a bee's experience of clover and of noon." Maybe that's a poet's way of saying, I want to get inside a bee's head.
How many nerve cells do you need for an emotion? For many computational capacities, also intelligent performances, the number of nerve cells that you need is actually diminutively small. A bee's brain has only about 1 million neurons, but each one of these neurons is about as finely branched as a fully grown oak tree. Every single neuron can make connection points with up to 10,000 other neurons, nerve cells, in that bee's brain. So we have a wiring diagram there that's still too complex for my neuroscientist colleagues to understand comprehensively. Many of the things that bees do sometimes look to an outsider as if the individual is just a negligible unit of that bigger thing that is the swarm or the hive. But if you look a little more closely, the decision-making is still performed by individuals. They come together and make decisions together based on individual experiences and memories that they've stored. But the group decisions that we might see are still made jointly by multiple individuals that contribute something.
When you talk about social learning among bees or bumblebees, it's very exciting to me to think that this is just not an instinctual, innate capacity for bees to work in concert with each other. There are some more able performers and others that have to observe and learn as they go from the advanced performers.
Indeed. So let's first of all describe the very elaborate social learning activities in bees that I think a decade ago no one would have suspected. So we started with some experiments where we taught bees to pull a string for a reward. And these kinds of string pulling tasks are a kind of historic intelligence test where people have tested apes, clever corvid birds, and so on to probe the flexibility that they had in getting to a reward that was out of reach, but for which you needed to pull a string to get to that reward.
And when you say corvid birds, you're talking about jays, crows, ravens,
ravens,
those types of birds?
Exactly, yeah. So the relatively large-brained birds that are being studied precisely for their intelligence. So in our case, we presented the bees with some artificial flowers, just a disc with a nectar reward in the center. We always give them a sugar reward if they've got something right. They reward themselves with sweetness if they find the right flowers. And so these artificial flowers were presented under a glass table and they were attached to a string. So the only way to get to the flowers was to pull on a string until you extracted it from underneath the table, and then you could get the reward in the center. But not only could bees learn this technique that no individual in their evolutionary history had ever encountered before, but they could also learn this by observation. So if you inserted one skilled individual into a group, a bee that had learned to pull a string, then over time, lots of other individuals would pick up this technique. First, just a few, and then it spreads through a whole colony and then basically becomes a kind of colony-specific culture. This is, of course, not part of their hardwired routine. No bees have ever had to pull strings for rewards, but they can not just learn it by themselves, but also by copying each other. And we've since found that this can also happen with even more elaborate things like, for example, rolling a ball across a horizontal field and putting it in a particular goal area. They can also learn this by observation from each other. And so there is a hitherto entirely unsuspected flexibility in the things that they can learn by copying.
So bees have actually tackled tricky little tasks similar to those that have been set in experiments for crows and ravens, which, by the way, are some of the smartest animals on the planet. I find that really striking. It's been shown that ravens are capable of humor and pulling pranks as well. To me, that sounds not just like doing a job, but like having a personality with feelings. If a bee can learn a task as complex as the string pull, can a bee, or raven, perhaps also feel pleasure in successful completion of a task, or conversely, feel stymied and frustrated when things go poorly? Lars Chitka himself isn't certain that bees experience what we would perceive as emotions. But he says he's more open to the idea today than he once was.
The question of whether an animal is intelligent is easier to answer. So when you're asking, can animal X pull a string to get a reward? If you've done your experiment correctly and all your controls, you can find a simple yes-no answer. You can ask, can an animal count? And the answer there for bees is also yes. For emotions, we can't talk to it. We can't ask, how do you feel today? For this reason, not too long ago, people would have regarded the question of insect emotions as ridiculous. In the 1980s, we had discussions with neuroscientists who did invasive experiments on cat brains, and they were quite confident back then in their assertion, well, cats don't feel anything. They're not conscious animals, so there's nothing to worry about. So I think attitudes have changed gradually. Certainly for vertebrates they have, but in insects, I think there is still some learning process that we're undergoing.
Chitka notes that scientific perspectives on pain, pleasure, and other emotional states in animals have changed dramatically in recent years, at least when it comes to primates, cats, and dogs. It's easy to think that insects have such a fleeting lifespan and are so diminutive in size that nothing would ever come from searching out emotions in them, individual or collective. And when I say collective emotion, I'm thinking of our notion of an angry swarm. But could we ever know what a single bee is feeling? One approach, Lars Chitka says, is to observe a bee's ability to endure discomfort in order to achieve a goal. Can a bee, figuratively speaking, grit its teeth?
So let's start with the simple case where pain is a kind of affective state, an emotion that is reflective of that animal feeling something unpleasant. So it is an emotion-like state. Some of the behavior can be mediated by just a reflex, where you just withdraw from the source of a stimulus. But there is more than that in us and in bees and other animals as well. One of the hallmarks of pain in humans and other animals is the flexibility of the response. For example, you can grit your teeth and dampen or inhibit a reflex when that's beneficial. And we find that in bees as well. They can do more than just reflexively, for example, retreat from a heated stimulus. They can actually suppress their rejection when there is a good reward.
Chitka says that bees also demonstrate something that looks like fear or trepidation. They can seem to be driven or swayed by the memory of a traumatic event. Could a bee, for instance, after having to deal with a spider somewhere, come down with a bad case of arachnophobia?
We did an experiment about 15 years ago. We were interested in the question of whether bees can learn about predation threat. And in this case, the question was about so-called crab spiders. These are predators that lurk on flowers. They just sit there and wait, and they're a bit like a chameleon in that they can actually take on, in some species at least, the color of the flowers on which they hide, and they pounce on unassuming pollinators. So we took what we called our robotic crab spiders, and the robot spider could briefly capture a bee between two sponge pads without injuring it and then release it. In the same way as an unsuccessful spider attack, a predator attack, where you as a prey have the opportunity to learn from the experience. And we did find that the bees learn to avoid the flowers with spiders. That was perhaps unsurprising. But the surprising thing was that, number one, their whole demeanor changed. They would fly very slowly and very cautiously, inspecting every flower after such simulated attacks. But the most surprising thing was that the experienced bees would display lots of false alarms. That is, they would inspect a flower that was actually perfectly safe and then reject it as if they'd seen a ghost. And so there wasn't a current stimulus of a spider. It was something that the bees conjured up from the past, having had this unpleasant experience. And so at least, and I'm now deliberately anthropomorphically speaking, but it did look a bit like a post-traumatic stress disorder. That opened my mind at least to the possibility that, hey, perhaps there is an anxiety-like state in these bees.
It's just one type of experiment, but it's repeatable and has consistent outcomes. And Lars Chitka believes it has rich implications for further research. Avoiding a spider attack, remembering the unpleasantness and the pain of it, well, those are all well and good. But can bees have fun? Do they ever play? This is a level of thought and emotion that with a tiny insect hardly seems worth wondering about. So this next study involving bumblebees was pretty mind-blowing for me.
We manipulate objects, including balls, just for the joy of the activity in itself. And the same seems to be the case with bees as well. We train bees to roll balls to a destination. That was a learned behavior in that case, but an unexpected observation as part of that experiment, we also found that some bees just came to these balls and rolled them around without any kind of sugar reward. So they just seemed to come back to the balls for the sake of rolling the balls around. And that, of course, mirrors what you find with many other animals, not just our familiar pet dogs, but squirrels, cats, and so on will also play with balls sometimes. So there is evidence then from multiple different lines of experiments, different paradigms, actually different labs as well. And it all converges in the same direction, namely that it is actually likely that there is a spectrum of emotion-like states in bees.
I did mention earlier that Lars Chitka is leaning toward a view of bees as capable of certain feelings, what you or I would call emotions. I'm still kind of stuck on Emily Dickinson on this point, because she could readily project feelings and thoughts onto animals. It's a little bit more difficult for me. What if human emotions really aren't exclusively human? If we traditionally think of a swarm of bees as angry, can a single bee experience happiness or joy? Well, I kind of want to believe so. We'll check in next with Tim Landgraf in Berlin. We heard him as we began describing the delicate task of applying tiny tags to the back of individual bees, assigning them unique numbers. Not anyone knows how to do that, and he'll tell us why he does. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Embark on a whimsical journey with The Appleseed and host Sam Payne. It's one of many shows from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. Wrap yourself in captivating stories, expertly woven by talented storytellers. You'll hear live studio audiences taking immense delight in a broad tapestry of tales, some humorous, others poignantly reflective. The Appleseed is always a family-friendly experience. It sparks imagination creative enough to make fiction feel like fact and bring real-life events back to life. The Appleseed. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder.
My sister and I were playing in my room, and then there was a fly walking, and I took it, and I pulled the wings out and made the fly a bug. And when my parents found out, they reacted really strongly. I mean, they were fine with most of the bad stuff that I did, but they weren't fine about that. So I kind of knew, okay, well, that was wrong. And even the smallest bugs may have feelings.
Tim Landgraf was 8 years old when that happened. It was a formative moment. Today, his intense curiosity remains, but he's figured out how to harmlessly track an individual honeybee as it performs its tasks in the hive and also when foraging outside the hive. You could ask, well, why is a computer scientist like him conducting research typically in the domain of a biologist or ecologist? Well, I'll answer that riddle very simply. He's a professor of artificial and collective intelligence, and he's using machine learning to better analyze the experiences of individual bees.
We use cameras and lighting and little tags that we glue on the back of the bees to know exactly who is who and where are they and how are they moving, right? And we use machine learning to detect, to track, to identify, to recognize behaviors, to recognize interactions. it's a whole pipeline of different steps that in the end creates a data set based on this huge data set of images that we record. We have positions and angles and trajectories and behaviors in time. And so we know exactly what every bee is doing, with whom she's doing it, and how long she's doing it, and where she's doing it. And is this the first time she was doing that? Or, you know, what are the patterns of that behavior? So the beehive is much more complex, I would say, than like a shoal of fish, for example, because each bee has so many different modes of behavior. It can vibrate, it can produce scents and odors, it can fly out and navigate and make own experiences, and then use these when she's back in the hive to communicate different things, like point others to directions and distances where they can find food. It's a vast landscape of communication behaviors. And we capture that in a matrix, which is basically encoding the strength of an interaction. And we have many of these matrices for every interaction type that we have.
Part of what Landgraf is doing seems to be focused on observing individual behaviors or choices made by bees. How much differentiation is there, if any at all? Or do these insects act more in lockstep, robotically?
Check it out, Corporal. We'll cover you.
Roger, roger.
You know, like those battle droids in Star Wars.
Are there different paths through life? You know, in humans, it's basically the same, right? So we start in our home with our parents, most of us, right? Then we go to school, and then we may end up going to college, and then work, and then in the end we die. And so similar life paths can be observed in honeybee colonies.
With machine learning and AI, Landgraf conducts these observations with vast amounts of data and amazing precision.
Life in a honeybee colony is very structured. If I know your age, I could guess pretty well what kind of task you're doing. Are you a nurse bee? Are you a forager bee? There are conditions that sometimes make a young bee, a biologically young bee, take up tasks that old bees would do. So young bees would normally be nurse bees, but sometimes they have to mature faster and become forager bees. So observing the colony in such a great detail with computer vision, machine learning, we can determine the task much better than just knowing the age. We know exactly what they're doing, with whom they're interacting. Okay, this is a forager bee. She will be likely to die in a couple of days. But that's, again, very similar to what we try to do in humans. Knowing everything about your health history makes my prediction much stronger.
Tim Landgraf uses tiny cameras in conjunction with advanced software to document what it is the bees do. This is what he referenced as computer vision, which bypasses that old traditional need for direct human observation. He also uses a tiny device he calls a robo-bee, a robotic stand-in that can go through various dance moves like a bee. Most of us learned years ago in school that honeybees dance as a mode of communication to tell their fellow bees the location of vital food sources. Landgraf notes that this waggle dance was discovered by an Austrian-born researcher named Karl von Frisch, who won a Nobel Prize in 1973 for cracking this dynamic code of the honeybees dance.
So there was a guy in the 1920s, 1940s, Karl von Frisch, who said, hey, bees communicate the location of food sources. They basically give a mathematical vector, a mathematical description of where food is. So what if we understood what in the dance is informative? So what carries information?
To find out, Landgraf's lab actually needs a tiny imposter, a wee little bee robot.
So we build a robot and we make it move like we see bees are moving, but we make this movement fully controllable, and we can control the wing movements, and we can control how hot it gets and the scent it has. We can have it float over the comb, or we can have it touch the ground. So we can switch on or off different cues associated with the dance and see whether that actually is understood by the other bees. So you can go deeper into how do they interact and what is it really communicated.
How many dancer bees have you watched with your own eyes looking into a hive?
Tens of thousands, I think. I was dreaming about bees dancing. So this is the point when you know that's too much, maybe. But the good thing is, the better your AI gets, the less you have to do yourself. So we don't watch all the recordings. It's impossible. The bee dance is only the tip of the iceberg. If you look deeper, there's so much more small changes that you don't really see. But on the individual level, we see small interactions. Sometimes I think there must be something that they negotiate before following a dance. So there's a dancer coming in and the dance follower. We had the robot do the same thing. And sometimes the robot wouldn't be followed at all. And sometimes bees would start right away and follow like crazy, crazily interested. So what is it that determines whether a dance follower becomes a dance follower? Is there some kind of, hey, this is what I found. You ready? You want to follow? That kind of interaction that negotiates whether the dancer starts dancing and the dance follower starts dance following. But we don't know what it is. Is there such a thing or not?
Much of what Landgraf is evaluating has to do with individualized functions, which must be attributable to individual minds. Division of labor seems to require both collective and individual intelligence.
Most foragers do not dance. The dance is basically a communication system that tells other bees where to go. It does not only say, hey, there's a food source. It says, go in this direction, fly that distance, and at the end of this vector, you'll find food, or water, or resin, or pollen, all these resources that bees need. And so most bees fly out, find food themselves, and come back. But there are times in the year when food sources or resources are scarce, and it makes sense to invest energy in this communication. But again, not all of those bees do that. Some bees do. And, you know, among 20,000 bees, you will see always a handful of dancers. And they have a big influence because it's a lot of work. They do a lot of work. And we haven't fully understood who those bees are that actually engage in this dance following. They decode the message. They fly out. They might not find it. They fly back. Haven't found it. They follow again the dance. And at some point, then they will find the food source. And it's remarkable because it kind of combines the collective with the individual. The individual intelligence is, okay, I can find food 10 kilometers away. Long, long flights are these. I can still find back. So I have some kind of navigational experience stored in my brain. And 10 kilometers, you can't see home. You cannot see where that little dot is. Not even with my eyes, and I have much better eyes than they have. They have to remember, okay, well, this tree, I've seen that tree. From there, I have to go this way. You know, so there's a lot of individual intelligence involved. And then it culminates in this collective interaction.
In one of his experiments tracking the whereabouts of tagged bees, Landgraf followed the complete and unique adult lives of 123 bees from the time they emerged out of their pupa stage all on the same day, with brood drawn from the very same hive. I didn't know that such a study was even feasible.
Every day, we go to the incubator, which is a little oven, let's say, at 34 degrees. We take out a brood frame that has honeybee brood. And since we do that every day at the same time, all the bees that have emerged are at most one day old. And we take all of them and we tag them. We glue little circular binary markers on their backs. And our computer vision pipeline detects those tags and decodes the number.
How much do these tags weigh?
It's basically paper, very thin, very lightweight. They don't feel it at all. They can fly. They can inspect the cells. We made them round and also curved, so they adapt nicely on their round thorax on the middle segment. And we do that at the very young age of one. They don't fly, they don't sting yet. So they're very calm and sweet. They don't know what's happening probably, and then we put them in the hive and then they're okay.
Can you also use these tags to track them when they're foraging outside the hive?
Yes, only at food sources that we provide. We don't know where they fly elsewhere. We have sugar solutions in 3D printed devices with bottles. So you screw a bottle on it. The bottle holds 200 milliliters of sugar water. They can drink through little slots. And the slots are arranged in a way that we can observe them from above with a camera. So they can only drink there. So when they are there and drink, then we can see their tags and read the tags.
So you put a food source out there, and then a bee finds it and comes back to do that dance to bring others to it.
Yeah, we can even bring them. It's way faster if you just take a bee, walk there, put it on the feeder, let her drink. And if it's not too far away, she'll find back.
I'm trying to understand why they would be so interested in the sugar water that you provide instead of all the naturally occurring flowers elsewhere.
That's why we do it in the late summer, where pretty much everything isn't in bloom anymore. If we do it in May or June, everything is in bloom. They will not drink from our food sources. They will be like, yeah, why? Why should I? Everything is in bloom here. But in late July, in August, here in Berlin, there's maybe a little clover in bloom, but you know, these are not rich food sources. They will love our sugar sources.
And then, of course, return to the hive and spread word. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our guests are Tim Landgraf and Lars Chitka, whose research and experiments are conducted in the area of bee behavior and sentience, individual and collective. In just a moment, we'll go from Landgraf's method of tracking honeybees with tiny tags placed on their backs to Lars Chitka's observations about bumblebee flight. I'd like to introduce you to another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, The Lisa Show, hosted by comedian, believer, and single mother Lisa Valentine Clark. The Lisa Show delves into most any challenge that meets us in the course of our lives, especially challenges in the realm of human relationships, whether it's parenting, mental health questions, or social issues. Lisa and her council of moms are willing to tackle it. Figuring life out is vexing enough without losing an ability to laugh or cry together or just plain talk things through. The Lisa Show. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. The 19th century Russian composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov created an enduring cliché with his musical representation of a bumblebee's flight. Whether or not he had any empathy with a humble bumblebee, like the poet of Amherst did, who knows? To follow a bumblebee for an hour, a day, or for over 30 days of its entire lifespan, you would need a sizable amount of modern technology and a teensy-weensy piece of radar equipment called a transponder, affixed to the back of your research subject. Ask and ye shall receive, because there is such technology. Chitka told me it's called harmonic radar.
We cannot put a transmitter on a bee, because a transmitter needs electricity, so it needs to be battery powered, and there's no battery small enough for a bee to carry it around. So what we use instead of a transmitter is a so-called transponder, which looks like a little antenna, but it doesn't actually emit its own signal. The bee has to carry this transponder, which looks huge. It's about 15 millimeters long, this little antenna on the back, but it's very lightweight compared to the carrying capacity of a bee. It bounces an incoming signal back to our radar device. And so it's called harmonic radar because our radar system emits one frequency. The transponder on the bee's back transposes it to a different frequency, a harmonic of the original frequency, so a multiple of that, which is then bounced back from the bee to another radar dish that picks up the signal. So the radio equipment in comparison to a bee is huge. So the whole arrangement, the radar equipment is mounted on a trailer that's about 3 meters high in its entirety. You've got this big rotating dish that emits the signal, and on top of that, a smaller dish that picks it up.
Maybe you could tell me now, what has your use of this transponder radar system turned up about bumblebee flight, the patterns, the habits?
What bees begin their foraging careers with is exploration around their native nests. In the case of bumblebees, also beginning to explore different food sources. In this early phase, just trying things, memorizing landmarks as well as possible foraging patches. And then once they've discovered something, some good foraging patches, they might switch from a phase of exploration to one of exploitation, where they then really become very focused on harvesting nectar, let's say, from one familiar patch or tree, just shuttling back and forth between that tree and the nest.
Now, I have seen a fascinating map that you have shared at times of the complete flight log of one particular bumblebee, and that bee was systematic. First, just going out to shop around, forays to get the lay of the land, but later, extremely direct and focused and efficient. You can tell that just by looking at the flight path. But I'm wondering, how much variation is there from bee to bee while doing this?
So there is quite a bit of variation between individuals. Some are very focused in their exploitation of particular food sources. Others never cease exploring. But we track individual bees with harmonic radar, where we can follow their entire careers from their maiden flight to their death, and in that way characterize precisely how much time they spend exploring and exploiting familiar sources. And yes, so there's quite a bit of personality difference between different individual bees.
Now, going back to what you were describing in the stage of exploration for a young bee and going out and then becoming an exploitative animal that's bringing back, you know, what it needs, in all of that learning, it seems to me that a bee has got to be able to deal with past, present, and future.
Indeed. It is quite clear that bees do form memories that they can retrieve much later in their lives. So we found, for example, that spatial memories that they make during their first exploration flight, they can return to locations they've been during that flight 10 days later. So they still remember them. And that in a bee's life is about a third of her lifespan. But they've visited, in this case, the location only a single time. It's been found earlier by Martin Lindauer, who did experiments in the 1950s. He looked at honeybee workers who spend the winter inside the hive. These worker bees live much longer. They live several months, and they form memories of spatial positions in autumn before overwintering. Then they're locked up while there is snow outside and they don't leave the hive. These bees are the first ones to leave the hive and provision it with new nectar once spring comes around. And several months later, these workers still remember where they've been in the autumn. The memories are also quite sophisticated. So Mandiam Srinivasan has found, for example, that bees remember not just multiple locations, but they also remember how each of the flower patches at these locations, how they smell, and they remember the correct scent with the location. If you blow the scent associated with these distant spatial memories into the hive, these bees go, aha, I've smelled that in location A, and will fly straight to the location where they've experienced this scent. So it's not just a memory of a position in space, but there is also an odor attached to it. So these memories are quite rich.
To have all of those rich memories and just to know multiple locations and the qualities of the flowers, and it just seems tragic that their lives are so short. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, many people have observed that human life is very short. I guess every being would like to live longer. but the capacity to memorize things and retrieve memories is tailored to the animal's lifestyle. And there are some animals that live much longer. Sea urchins, for example, can live 80 years. And trees, of course, centuries. But there's no sense for a tree or a sea urchin to store many memories. And in the case of a bee, because there is so much that goes with its lifestyle, that means it has to be good at memorizing things. That's what they do. So within that short period of 3-4 weeks, they have to memorize and retrieve lots of things. And so that's what their biology dictates they need to do, even though their lives are very short.
So with this information that there are all kinds of minds among living things, and as that expands, and as we sort of redefine what the criteria are that allow us to say something has a mind, has that changed your choices in your interventions in the world?
Yes, it has. These insights have changed how we treat bees in the laboratory. We are trying to keep them in ways that are conducive to their well-being, and we want to minimize suffering in any kind of research that we do. And I try to encourage colleagues to do the same. To the extent that at least any risk of suffering can be minimized, and we can get people to think, do they really need to test as many insects as they do for their particular question? Is the invasiveness or the severity of a treatment justified by the knowledge gains? I think that needs some thinking about. We have no legal constraints in insect work, as opposed to people working with zebrafish and rats and so on. There is nothing legally in place to take care of the insects that we work with, but I think people at least voluntarily should think about these issues and make sure that they're avoiding unnecessary suffering.
I had a similar exchange with Tim Landgraf about how his professional focus on bee life, you could call it bee-ing, using high tech to study tiny ephemeral life forms, how might these activities of his have informed his really big picture perspectives? Here's that exchange. I said something very early on in our conversation that was about the small things in the giant picture of the cosmos. How often do you just kind of try to wrap your head around the sheer implausibility of all of these connections?
I just remember I did that today when driving home. I think I do. I think I don't do that in a systematic way. But for example, you know, if I'm stuck in traffic, I think of all these heads and these brains sitting behind their wheels, thinking something, having plans. Their kids are waiting at home, or they have to get their suit from the cleaner to go to a wedding, or I don't know. And then I imagine, well, this is just a tiny patch that I observe on this great planet, which isn't really a big planet, to be honest, but it has so much complexity. And then I wonder, okay, we're just at the beginning of understanding of how complex and how beautiful this is. And I think we talked about AI. I think AI will help us understand what we are, who we are, where we're going, you know, help us to find a good way to become the humans that we want to be.
As you reflect on those divergent agendas that all these people have and the complexity of it all, and they're situated on this planet that's complex, how do you respond emotionally to those kinds of reflections? What happens to you in your feelings?
How do I feel? Well, I like to entertain these thoughts. I like to follow up on them. And especially when you're stuck in traffic, there's time to do that. And I think the interest and the awe of looking at these things, sometimes it's capped by my capacity to hold everything in my brain. I think that is the tiny little bit of dissatisfaction that I feel, that I can't hold this, that I can't follow all these lives, and that it's just too much. But before that, I think I enjoy zooming out and just grasping the hugeness and the vastness of everything. You know, when you grow up, I guess we all had the same moment, some earlier, some later, when you realize how small we are and how insignificant everything is in the whole universe and how little we know.
How little we know and are. But beyond that, very specifically, even though a lot of new information has emerged recently about the individuated minds of bees and their autonomous behaviors, their unique contributions within the larger hive mind, a whole lot of mystery remains. Dickinson's line, "Oh, for a bee's experience of clover and of noon," is probably not poetry as sweet as honey. It's likely more bittersweet, because it touches on something inaccessible to us. But I'm persuaded to try to empathize with these tiny life forms with their segmented bodies and wings and six legs and giant compound eyes. Actually, they have three more situated atop the head. We've just heard how they have a capacity to feel and know and remember and learn, perhaps even to play. And I've got all of those things too. After recording my conversations with researchers Lars Chitka and Tim Landgraf, Eric Schultzke, one of our Constant Wonder producers, enthusiastically brought to my attention something from one of his favorite movies. This short clip resonates with me, given what we've been talking about in this episode. There are common themes, from poetry to other modes and codes of communication, dancing bees, for instance, looking through lenses that are not our own in an effort to see what other eyes see that we do not. This comes from the 1981 classic film My Dinner with Andre. Playwright Andre Gregory here invokes the honeybee dance as somehow germane to his infinitely larger cosmic vision.
You see, I keep thinking that what we need is a new language. A language of the heart. Some kind of language between people that is a new kind of poetry. That's the poetry of the dancing bee that tells us where the honey is. And I think that in order to create that language, you're going to have to learn how you can go through a looking glass into another kind of perception where you have that sense of being united to all things. And suddenly, you understand everything.
Our guests have been Tim Landgraf, a professor of artificial and collective intelligence at the Free University of Berlin in Germany, and Lars Chitka, a zoologist and ecologist. He's based at Queen Mary University in London. Chitka's most recent book is titled The Mind of a Bee. Today's episode was produced by Eric Schultzke with help from Elaine Scott and Audrey Hughes. Sound design was by Josh Fouts. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.